Well, good afternoon, everybody. I realize there are many people coming in yet, but I think it would be nice to get started. My name is Heather Pryor, and I'm a presenter and a moderator this afternoon. So thank you for coming. Our first speaker is David Dornbos from Calvin College. All right, welcome. Please.
Well, it's good to be here. As far as I can tell, this is the only agricultural biotechnology talk. And so, wow, the weight of the world to represent this whole big segment of transgenic crops. My goal this afternoon is essentially to convince you that the technology is a good thing, but the specific traits that are being utilized within agriculture right now are fun and they work, but they're not necessary. In fact, indirectly, they're tied to a food production system that is inherently unsustainable. And so I don't want to throw biotechnology under the bus. What I do want to do is come back at the very end and talk about maybe a few traits that I think could be useful going forward. So that's essentially where I want to go. My background is in crop production and physiology. I have master's and PhDs from The Ohio and Iowa State University. I worked in agricultural industry for 15 years prior to going to Calvin. I've taught at Calvin now for 14 years. When in ag industry, working for Syngenta, I was the director of product development in North America for 8 years. So I oversaw the field testing of BT corn and Roundup Ready soybeans, the very first events to hit the marketplace. And that's a little bit of what I'll talk about today. And after that, I worked for another 8 years as the global head of the seed production research group for Syngenta. So I got involved in on the production side of crops with GMO traits in them. So as a way of maybe setting a scene, what I want you to do or ponder or reflect on a little bit is Genesis 1. After each creation day, God said that it was good. Do these transgenic traits make it still be good? Genesis 1:29, Adam was commanded to name the species. By naming, you give inherent value. So you've got the intrinsic value of Genesis 1. The naming gives individual species value. Is this value maintained by the use of transgenic crops in the current industrialized monoculture-based system? And then finally, Genesis 2:15, the dual command to serve and protect. Agriculture has a huge global footprint, huge. Are we, in the way we produce our food, serving and protecting God's intrinsically valuable creation? So reflect on those as we go. Transgenic crops. There are a variety of popular reasons for and against these crops. Reasons for that I often hear is, yes, they increase crop yields. They protect global food security, particularly in the face of a growing global population. They provide income potential to farmers, although there's no evidence that the increased productivity of transgenic crops has reduced food price. They do reduce pesticide use, depending on how you define pesticide. If you define pesticides as chemical agrochemicals, definitely. If you define them as proteins expressed in a BT corn plant, then probably not. They are or have been and can be used to deliver vitamins, potentially. There are reasons against the use of GMOs. Often I hear, isn't it playing God? We've heard that already in the past couple of days. Last night, Dr. Collins spoke to that. I've heard the question, the challenge, it's not natural. Is it, in fact, not natural for genes to move between species? And that it may increase pesticide use depending on how you define a pesticide. So I started the abstract with a rather confrontational sentence. So I wrote in the abstract, transgenes in industrialized agriculture perpetuate an environmentally unsustainable system that projects externalized costs on an unwitting public. Well, those could be fighting words. So what do I mean by externalized costs? What do I mean by an unwitting public? So it turns out that less than 1% of Americans farm. Most of the rest, we go to the grocery store to get our food. It appears in the grocery store. We have very little understanding beyond that of where it comes from or what it takes to produce that food. So that's maybe the unwitting part. Externalized costs is another thing. So externalized costs are benefits not transmitted through the purchase price. So when you go to the grocery store, according to Jules Preti in Reality Checks, he argues you actually pay for the food there. The food comes across the belt, you flash your card, and you pay for it. But he's going to say you pay for it at least two more times. You pay for it in your taxes. So federal withholding tax is a big chunk of that that goes to support the farm bill. That farm bill is supporting a certain kind of agricultural system. You are paying for that system. You're going to pay for it in terms of environmental and healthcare side effect costs. So environmental side effect costs might be your water bill. So how does food relate to your water bill? Well, if you plow soils and there's runoff, those sediments go into your water. That water has to go through a purification plant to remove the sediments, to deflock it, to take pesticide residues out. Anything we do on land is going to end up in the water. So you pay for that in your water bill. You don't necessarily recognize that as a food cost, but it is. It's a food production, a food system cost. The big one is healthcare. So if you go to the CDC says 75% of our healthcare dollars in the United States, $3.8 trillion a year, 75% of that is to treat chronic disease. The number one cause of chronic disease is lifestyle choice. Lifestyle choice. It's what we eat, what we swallow, inhale, to the degree we do or don't exercise. So corn, number one use for corn these days now is ethanol. Number two, animal feed. Number one use for soybeans is animal feed. Meat consumption in the United States is clearly tied to a wide variety of chronic diseases. Corn is, the remainder of corn is generally used to make processed foods. So high fructose corn syrup, turns out, is a pretty good sized chunk of it. We know high fructose corn syrup is a heavy driver of diabetes too. So to a significant degree, something less than $2.9 trillion per year in the United States alone can be attributed to our food system, at least indirectly. In part, not in whole, but certainly in part. So the main points. I'm going to argue that transgenic crops are not necessarily bad or wrong. I'm going to argue that current transgenes definitely do protect yield. They do not increase yield potential. They protect current yield capacity. There's an important distinction there. There's that current transgenes apply to unsustainable monocultures. So I am going to throw monocultures under the bus in spite of the fact that that's the industry I worked in for 15 years. And go further to say we should consider adopting part or attitudes around the concept of agroecology, and that in fact different kinds of transgenes may be useful in that context. If we go to an agroecological food production system, we quite frankly don't need BT corn. It's irrelevant. We don't need herbicide tolerance traits. They're irrelevant. They're not necessary in those kinds of systems. So transgenics, just to make sure that we're all clear, are organisms whose genetic makeup have been altered by the addition of genetic material from another, a different, unrelated organism. So you're going to take a gene from one species and put it into another. This is to be distinguished from natural selection, which is kind of the Darwinian idea of survival of the fittest. So natural selection produced tomatoes like those pictured in the top picture there. Those are native, natural, white tomatoes. That's one of how the ways tomatoes would look if you were to find them in their native state. you probably wouldn't even recognize them as being tomatoes. So that's what natural selection produced. Then we've got selective breeding. So in the same way that you would develop different breeds of dogs, cats, corn hybrids, tomato breeders developed tomatoes that we would now recognize. They could be the kind of the small bunches of the bite-sized tomatoes or big ones. Those tomatoes, the bottom two pictures, are consequences or results of selective breeding probably over hundreds, if not thousands, of years. So you can breed tomatoes by crossing parents of the same species and selecting for genes, essentially visible traits that you value. So you might value a tomato that's red, that's juicy, that you can pick when it's green, ripen it later, that stores well, lots of those kinds of things. So biotechnology, on the other hand, is going to imply the transfer of one or more genes, typically one or two is about all that biotechnologists in the plant world can handle, from one species to another. So I'm going to argue that transgenic crops are not inherently bad or wrong because they happen naturally, essentially. So insulin from biotechnology is widely accepted. It turns out that with the incidence of diabetes 2, which is driven largely by the consumption of corn-based products, I'll note, there aren't enough pig pancreases to produce the insulin needed to fulfill the needs of people with diabetes 2 in the world. We could grind up all the pancreases of all the pigs in the world and we would not have enough insulin today. So what we did, or what people did several decades ago, this is not new news, is they bioengineered bacteria. So a human gene for insulin was introduced into a bacterial genome. Those bacteria are grown in fermentation tanks. The bacteria are killed, the insulin's extracted, and it's sold and marketed as something like Humulin R. It's human insulin human injection recombinant DNA origin. So we inject biotech products. Should we be concerned with eating them? Bacteria, notably Agrobacterium tumefaciens, a number of viruses, do and have for eons moved genes between species. So the species barrier has been porous for a really long time. Something like 6 to 8% of the human genome is viral. Agrobacterium tumefaciens, you might recognize crown galls. You might have been in the woods or the forest or trees in your yard. You've seen those before. Those are caused by Agrobacterium tumefaciens, which is a weak parasite. And it lives, the Agrobacterium tumefaciens plays a little hormonal trick with the plant. So it's emulating two plant hormones to cause the gall to develop. It creates a food source and a home for the bacterium where it can use a variety of different kinds of molecular machinery to extract genes from one plant. The bacterium can move to another plant where it can insert those plant genes. So across different plant species. So that bacteria is bacteria and viruses have naturally moved DNA among plant species for a long period of time. That's what biotechnologists have done. In fact, plant biotechnologists tried to use Agrobacterium tumefaciens to do this for a really long time with some success. It turns out other tools like biolistics turn out to be a bit more efficient. So current transgenes protect yield potential. So I'm going to focus here a little bit on BT corn. There are a number of different transgenes now in use. BT corn, a variety of crops resistant to herbicides, mostly Roundup, Monsanto's product, but also Liberty Link. Dicamba now is in the marketplace. And there is corn that's resistant to the corn rootworm as well. So BT corn is necessary within an industrialized monoculture system because of the European corn borer. As well, a little bit the corn earworm, maybe the fall armyworm, but primarily the European corn borer. So this little insect pest has historically stolen something on the order of $1 billion a year in corn yield. So they primarily cause their damage by being a borer. They bore into the stalk and they feed on the vascular tissues that exist between leaves and root, and they undermine the health of the plant. You're probably more familiar with the European corn borer because every once in a while, if you strip a ear of sweet corn back, you find a worm in the tip, it's probably him or the corn earworm. That's probably what you're seeing. They'll feed on that part too. It turns out that this is a specialized pest. It feeds on corn, 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 really nothing else. So as a specialized pest, it can become very quickly a significant problem if it sees these inviting large fields of one kind of plant, corn. Bacillus thuringiensis is a bacterium that's been known for some time. It was originally noticed to cause silkworm colony collapse. Silkworms are a lepidopteran insect, and Bacillus thuringiensis produces a protein, a single gene coding for a protein that has been for decades marketed as Dipel and used by organic farmers as a natural biological. So you grow up the Bacillus thuringiensis, you kill them, you emulsify them into a powder, you can spray or sprinkle your powder on top of cabbages or broccoli or corn plants and control cabbage loopers and other things like that. Are all members of Lepidopteran insect. The bacterium is on the right. It turns out what you could also do then in a very targeted way is use tools of biotechnology to identify, clip out the BT gene, determine its code, pair it with an antibiotic marker, an antibiotic that would kill a corn cell if the marker were not there, build a BT gene cassette. In the early days, we used Biolistics, which was literally a 22 caliber shell. You'd put copies of the gene cassette on the particles. You'd kind of take out the bullet and you'd pack it, make like a shotgun shell. They use gold dust initially. They've gone then to CO2. And you literally shoot those cassette covered particles, gold particles, into a corn callus tissue. So you can take a single corn cell, create a callus tissue. These are undifferentiated corn cells, a little lump. And you literally shoot them, and you're hoping that an intact gene cassette sloughs off the bullet inside the nucleus of a cell. And if faced with that, the DNA repair mechanisms would not necessarily recognize, hopefully, that little DNA fragment as not being self, would put it into the genome, the corn genome somewhere, and express it. So that's what a callus tissue looks like, a callus tissue that was shot. And what you do is you treat that callus tissue with antibiotic. The antibiotic would kill all those corn cells unless there was a single cell that had expressing antibiotic resistance. If that cell is expressing antibiotic resistance, there's a good probability that it's also expressing BT. And so what you do is then you can play these little hormonal tricks, the same tricks as Agrobacterium tumefaciens plays. You can modulate the relative concentrations of auxin and cytokinin and cause this undifferentiated cells, clump of cells, to start producing little roots, little shoots, eventually get a little corn plant. You can put a little corn borer larva on that corn plant. Oh boy, 2 minutes, huh? And you see if the gene is, you see if the corn plant's killed by the gene or not. Once you've got a corn plant that's got BT in it, then it's just a matter of mechanics to produce seed. You sell it to farmers and they plant it in their monoculture fields. So BT corn works. Those are my kids about 20 years ago when they were 8 and 10. You've got genetic isolines, same genetic makeup, same hybrid, but with and without BT. With BT is on the left. And what you find is that depending on the ECB pressure, you can get anywhere from 3 to 10 bushel per acre yield advantages. Lots of locations, lots of years. So a 10% yield gain is a lot. Conventional breeding might give you a quarter of a bushel per year in terms of a breeding cycle. So these traits apply to unsustainable monocultures. So this is a little report card generated by the World Watch Institute, but there are lots of examples. Essentially, if you see the first column on the left, agro, that's thinking about an agricultural field as an agro ecosystem. And if you look at the colors for food fiber production, water quality, water quantity, biodiversity, they're almost all not green, which means they're performing at something less than they should be. And the trend arrows are all down. So our agricultural ecosystems are definitely not healthy. They're productive yet because we're supporting them artificially with pesticides, irrigation, fertilizers. But fresh water, a little further over to the right, is heavily impacted by what we do on land. So whatever we put on an agricultural field is going to end up in the water. And so agriculture, so the health of our water coming out of off these landscapes is also impacted. So there's been this movement within industrialized agriculture for the last 20 years to make agriculture more sustainable. And it works to a degree. We have reduced soil erosion from 8 bushels per acre to 2 bushels per acre. We have increased nitrogen use efficiency from 20 to 25% to 40%. But what that means is we're still losing 2 bushels of topsoil for every bushel of corn produced. We're still losing 60% of nitrogen fertilizer applied to water, to air. So integrated pest management, same sort of story. So we've got an inherently unstable food system. And I'm arguing that this is tied to the monoculture capacity. Biodiversity loss is clearly an issue. Species extinction rates are 100 to 1,000 times the geologic baseline. Agriculture, you think about Iowa, Nebraska, entire states are monoculture fields of corn or soybean with very little else. Monocultures imply no biodiversity. The farmer is doing everything that he can to keep other kinds of plants out there, out of there. If you've got only corn plants, you can't have predator insects because there isn't anything for them to eat 9 months out of the year. So this goes to insect biodiversity, mammal, bird, bacterial, soil fungal biodiversity. Biodiversity loss is a huge issue. So I would argue that we should adopt agroecology and think differently about how we produce food, going away from monocultures. So agroecology is the application of ecological concepts and principles to the design and management of sustainable ecosystems. Look at the tall grass prairie, look at the forest. The idea is to model how we produce food after ecosystems that are known to be sustainable. So what's a key feature of a sustainable ecosystem? Well, first thing that you see is, I hope, polycultures. You don't have all of one kind of plant growing there. So imagine a cornfield, or imagine my vegetable garden, which is more sustainable. So polycultures promote biodiversity, and actually polycultures rely on biodiversity. Monocultures reward labor use efficiency. Less than 1% of Americans farm. So industrialized agriculture is extremely efficient, producing calories per unit of human labor. So when you have a 48-row planter, it doesn't take long to plant 20,000 acres with one person. At the expense of soil loss, nitrogen, irrigation water, insect biodiversity, fungal biodiversity. Polycultures need functional biodiversity to be effective. If you have effective biodiversity, you can use the system itself, rotating crops to provide nitrogen. You can maintain healthy populations of predators. You don't need to apply pesticides. European corn borer is never going to be a problem in that field because I do have corn, it's just out of the picture, but it's one patch and I move it year to year. So I can't get rootworm, I won't have rootworm problems because rootworms are in the soil. As long as you rotate, you can break those life cycle changes. So you can use various biological controls, insect predators, pheromone traps. Yeah, some tillage, but mostly shade. Notice that I keep the soil covered year around, not just during the 3 months of the year that a tropical plant like corn is growing in the state of Iowa, which is not tropical. So transgenes, ECB is just seldom a problem. If you have an interplanted kind of system, ECB don't show up. Or if they do show up, there's so few of them that they're not economically significant because they're specialist pests. Polycultures reduce the density of specialty insects. Turns out all of the ones that transgenes are going after are specialized insects of corn. But global food security, how are we going to feed a growing human population? Aren't we tied to that system? And the answer is no, absolutely not. The evidence is very clear. I can point you to paper after paper where it's been done. Growing food in polycultures anywhere from 2 to 6 to 16 species will increase food production capacity on an area basis by anywhere from 30 to 230%. So we get more food in a polyculture, but not more food per unit of human labor. But isn't global food security about capacity of producing food on an area basis? So transgenic crops could be useful. I'm wrapping up. Potential transgenes. Global climate change is increasing temperatures. So if we could develop transgenic traits that provide tolerance, heat stress tolerance to plants, that would be helpful. So there's been some interesting work with heat shock proteins. There are some natural plant protection mechanisms, use of salicylic acid. So plants use common aspirin as a way of communicating in arming themselves against fungal attack, frost tolerance, nitrogen use efficiency. There are some people working in each of these areas. The problem would be mainly is you can't use most of the biotechnology tools within agriculture environments because the process patents are held by a few large life science companies. So unless you're a Syngenta or a Monsanto or a DuPont, you're probably financed out. And they were originally chemical companies, so they're protecting an income stream. So seek food, justice. I'd love to see us reconcile our agricultural ecosystems and all of the other ecosystems that they're tied with, and have quality food accessible to all people. Maybe a little less corn. All right, questions?
Have you followed the process of yellow rice and whether it's making an impact on nutrition?
Golden rice is not making a big impact on nutrition, and it's because people who are doing food security work in these places also understand that if you grow leafy green vegetables, you can get plenty of vitamin A just by eating these greens. You run into cultural issues in places like Cambodia where you take classes. They're not interested in rice and yellow. They want white rice.
So theoretically, I've agreed with you for a long time. I think the Achilles heel is something you mentioned, Pastor, quickly, is labor.
Yeah.
So I would guess a large percentage of the room had grandparents in part.
Yes.
I also guess a large percent of the room really aren't interested in farming.
Yes.
And that's the American population. A good part of our immigrant issue is tied to they're growing the food that we do not want to grow.
Yeah. I don't see a way around that one.
Yeah.
Now, I will say that, you know, we don't necessarily need to go back to how we done it in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. In the vegetable garden that you showed, I can produce enough vegetables to support 4 families year-round in Michigan, putting in maybe 6 to 8 hours a week for 6 months of the year. So maybe more of the victory garden concept, but better yet, CSAs are popping up all over the place. There is definitely a slow food movement, a foodie movement that is definitely pushing in the right directions. So, you know, as a consumer, vote with your dollars, and then guess who will grow.
All right, I think we'll leave the questions for there, but hopefully David will be happy to answer questions after the session.
I'm not going
thanks again.